This is a Defocus Media production. What's up, everyone? It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glovin.
And I'm Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, resident optometry nerd.
And welcome to Defocus Media, optometry's number one podcast, where we discuss the hottest topics, latest technology, eyewear, practice management, and more. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Sight. It awakens us to the present moment, guides us through essential daily tasks, shows us the road immediately ahead, and a future we can only hope to witness. Sight gives us hope, but retinal diseases can take our sight away, along with the hope that goes with it. At Iveric Bio, we see a world where vision is preserved. Our mission is to deliver transformational therapies for people with retinal diseases so they can live with hope in sight. The freedom to drive, the ability to work, the comfort of looking into a loved one's eyes, or the simple confidence to knowingly say, "I see." Iveric Bio. Hope in sight.
It's a new episode of the Defocus Media Podcast. I'm Dr. Jen Lyerly, and I am joined by a world-renowned speaker in optometry. If you've been to conferences, you know you go to his lectures and you always learn a lot. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Mila Brugic.
Thank you, Jen. Appreciate you having me on the show, too.
Well, Dr. Brugic, I see you're coming to us live from your optometry office. So would you mind sharing a little bit about your clinic, what a day in your life is like as an optometrist?
Yeah, so I'm a part owner of a four-location practice in Northwest Ohio. I have two other partners. We have eight doctors total in the practice. And I see patients out of two of the locations, mainly one, and then I go to another office about every other week to see patients. And it's really kind of carved out into more specialty patients at this point. But part owner, been in private practice for the last 21 years, so it's been really just an awesome journey to see where we were in optometry, where we are today, which is a massive evolution, and even to understanding some of the things on where we're going is just really, really encouraging.
Well, as a private practice owner, medical optometry, I know, is probably a very big part of what you do. Have you seen a big increase in the amount of medical care you've been called upon to do as an optometrist?
Yeah, 100%. Jen, you know this as well, too. I always, and you know, when I go back to 2002, one of the things that always interested me most in optometry was the things that we could do stuff about, places where we could potentially influence long-term outcomes. And that meant either us being directly involved in the treatments or being able to immediately identify the subspecialties where patients could get benefits from. And all of that has expanded tremendously over the last, I was going to say 21 years, but the last 5 years, it's just literally flipped. If somebody graduated optometry school 5 years ago, things that we're doing today weren't available back then. So everything's just changing so fast, and it's becoming an increasingly important part to the practice. Saying that though, Jen, I've always been a strong proponent that comprehensive care involves not losing sight of really what we're doing as well too on the optical side, the contact lens side as well too, but also incorporating that into the bigger medical care of these patients. So to directly answer your question, yeah, it's becoming an increasingly important part of our practices.
I love that you said it mirrors so much what myself, Daryl Glover here, we happen to practice both in Raleigh, North Carolina at different types of practices, but we've been talking to each other the last few years and noticing, you know, optometry care, I think, has gotten harder. The patients that we're seeing are more difficult. We've been noticing an increase in the difficulty of our eye exams as, you know, theoretically, we should be even better clinicians 10 years out from school. We're more skilled now. But it's because the needs of our patients have been increasing. And so as we are knowing more, there's more science, there's more things that with innovations for us to provide for care, that means deeper conversations, more things that we need to be doing. And yes, it's making comprehensive eye care more difficult, but also so much more rewarding.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jen. And I think too, it even puts more of a responsibility on us because now we have so much facets of optometry to really stay abreast on and really understanding and knowing where to send patients for care and also providing those that care inside of our offices as well too.
That's a great segue to our topic for today's podcast. It's rethinking macular degeneration, rethinking geographic atrophy, rethinking dry macular degeneration. I think we've all come into optometry care of macular degeneration with a certain mindset. And that's been really shaken up with some new innovations and technology coming out. And so we're going to dive into that on this episode and talk about how do we reset our mind to what modern macular degeneration care is. And I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors on today's podcast. This podcast is brought to us by Averic Bio and Astellas Company, but this is an independent podcast. We're going to be having a conversation that's totally our own, but we appreciate their support in making this podcast possible. All right, let's talk about this mindset. We've been doing a series of podcasts on macular degeneration, and historically, I think we've thought, hey, dry, non-exudative macular degeneration is mild disease. Wet macular degeneration is severe disease. But even that core mindset, we probably need to start rethinking. So how would you feel, or if you're talking to an optometrist, how would you kind of convince them that dry macular degeneration is actually still potentially very severe?
Yeah. So the more you understand, the more you realize about things, the more you realize as well, too, when we start seeing clinical signs of things, there's been a process that's been occurring for several years in these patients. So where we used to say, I remember describing confluent or intermediate sized drusen as soft drusen. That's kind of what we used to say. And we used to think, all right, this increases risk of going to wet AMD. But when you didn't have true treatments for wet AMD, or even when we didn't understand what to do for dry AMD, we always had to kind of somehow clinically put it into categories. So we'd always say, oh yeah, if you're not leaking, if there's no hemorrhaging, if there's no neovascularization, that's mild. If you're more severe, if you're leaking, that's wet. There was always this kind of lingering category of macular degeneration that not a lot of just the general community talked about because there was nothing we could do. It was actually the most frustrating form of macular degeneration that we had, and that's geographic atrophy. And that is really nothing more than long-term tissue destruction in individuals that have been compromised. Their macula is not functioning the way that they're supposed to. And now the tissue is responding by literally killing itself off. And this is a problem, and it's literally reframed the way that we're thinking about these patients. I've had more people in the last year, healthy individuals, ask me about my mother or my father or somebody in my family has macular degeneration. What can I do to make sure that I do not get this? And I love that conversation because I always tell them an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I give them the guidance. And there's really three that I give patients. No smoking, good UV protection, and make sure you're increasing your dietary intake of lutein and zeaxanthin. And I tell them exactly where it's found. Dark green vegetables, kale, corn, spinach, orange peppers, corn, and egg yolks. That's where those micronutrients are just found. If there are additional concerns, we actually sell high doses of lutein and zeaxanthin in our practice. And we also have a way to measure those levels through macular pigment optical density testing as well, too. But again, there is unfortunately this kind of blurring of lines between mild versus severe. And this whole thought process where if it's dry, it's mild, and if it's wet, it's severe, it's changing very, very quickly because of our understanding of the pathophysiology and also new treatments that we can provide patients with dry and some of the more advanced forms of dry as well.
I think some of these studies that have come out about the vision loss associated with geographic atrophy, it does take me by surprise because, again, I've historically had this mindset of like, oh, wet, that's the vision loss patients. But you know, there was a cohort study recently published of 1,900 patients with geographic atrophy. 66.7% went on to lose their driver's license within 2 years of their diagnosis. So these are people that are losing functional vision. It's completely changing their life. They had geographic atrophy as the cause of that, which in the past we've had zero treatment for. There would have been nothing for eye care provider to do. And it's, you know, something that we really need to be aware of. This is fast progressive vision loss, actually.
Yeah. And Jen, you bring up such good points here. We I think in eye care, we become a little bit numb to it because we're talking about this. We're seeing this on a daily basis. Now let's take a step out of our shoes, our clinical shoes, and let's just go to the general public and let's ask them questions. And if we ask the general public, hey, you have five senses, which one would you be most concerned if you lost today? Sight is always number one on any study that you ever look at anywhere. When you just think about that one little thing, you reframe the way personally for myself. I know because, you know, we're so used to processes that we sometimes forget about the influence that we have on our patients. So I have to even remind myself too, because I'm a very process guy. So when I'm walking into these exam rooms, I have to remember what we're working with and what we're dealing with, and the fact that we're dealing with patients' most valuable sense. Saying that, Jen, I think that means we always have to have our antenna up. I think it means that we almost have to have an extra level of guard. We always need to be thinking about how can we catch even the smallest forms of GA sooner, and how can we be better so that we can get these patients established for appropriate care patterns for when technologies do become available that can treat these patients and ultimately slow it down. That's what we're doing. Unfortunately, we can't stop anything, but we can at least slow it down now and give these individuals hope. And like you said, that statistic is startling, but unfortunately not surprising. You and I are both aware of that. But we can now at least maybe give them a little bit more time of functional vision.
One more stat, just in case you guys are thinking like, okay, how severe are we talking about? 42% of patients that are diagnosed with geographic atrophy are legally blind. I mean, this is very devastating to vision. I think this is a perfect time for us to show a little commercial to talk about this more.
Sight. It awakens us to the present moment, guides us through essential daily tasks, shows us the road immediately ahead, and a future we can only hope to witness. Sight gives us hope, but retinal diseases can take our sight away, along with the hope that goes with it. At Iveric Bio, we see a world where vision is preserved. Our mission is to deliver transformational therapies for people with retinal diseases so they can live with hope in sight. Freedom to drive, the ability to work, the comfort of looking into a loved one's eyes, or the simple confidence to knowingly say, I see. Iveric Bio. Hope in sight.
All right, so we've got this condition. We've got geographic atrophy. We know that it can cause very fast, progressive, devastating vision loss that completely changes our patient's ability to do their functional dailies of activity. And there's this treatment now, FDA approved, that will slow down the progression of GA. What do you think doctors need to know to really start embracing this mindset of care into their daily practice?
Yeah, so I think a few things that we kind of just on a daily basis, we need to be thinking about. So first and foremost, Jen, we've incorporated advanced imaging technologies as part of every single examination so that everybody that's coming in is getting a standard series or set of tests that gives us the ability to see things even before we're walking into the exam room. You know, I remember a time when we used to have to wait for the pupils to dilate and then see, why is this patient's vision limited? Well, it's very similar. The process is still the same. We still have to do those things professionally, but the benefit to seeing things before we actually walk into the exam room with patients is we're armed with information that we just didn't have before. What's also interesting too is with this advanced technology, we can now do time comparisons. So we can see what a patient looked like 6 months ago or a year ago, whenever we measured that patient in the past. And this is just imaging technologies. This is fundus scans. These are fundus images. You now take that into consideration with respect to the OCTs that we have and everything else that we're doing to monitor these patients' health. And we've literally created a paradigm shift. We are now catching things that, because we're seeing them at an earlier level, we can monitor them, detect them, and provide patient guidance in my mind, a better way, because we're learning more about these conditions more and more so. So I think we need to be hypercognizant on the ground floor as clinicians when we're seeing patients about two things. One, if we're seeing something early, we have a true influence on it now, in particular when it comes to macular degeneration and specifically geographic atrophy. And two is we need to make sure that we're monitoring these things closely and providing the appropriate referral protocols as well. Saying all of that, sometimes I think when we start talking about disease, we forget about the importance of making sure these patients can optimally function. And what I mean by that is we get so entrenched in the disease that we sometimes forget to update glasses. We sometimes forget to update the optical prescriptions. We sometimes forget to provide patients with additional magnification through appropriate prescriptions. That's our job. When we start seeing some of these new treatments, we're partnering with retina specialists. They're providing the treatments, but they're banking on us to make sure that this individual is staying as functional as possible as they're going through the treatments. So everything shifted in terms of what the expectations are. And I think we clinically need to be much more cognizant about the early GA patients or geographic atrophy patients, because what was once largely ignored because we couldn't do anything about it, we now have the ability to intervene earlier. And because of that, we need to make sure that we're catching those lesions sooner.
And, you know, detecting these small lesions, it can be very difficult. I had a patient recently where we were, you know, obviously with the dilated exam, you're getting such a big view. Seeing the impact of smaller areas of drusen is already quite difficult. But then we've got this imaging, which will help us assist with that, where you can really see the drusen in higher detail, your magnified view so much better.
Yes.
So we recently incorporated imaging capabilities that gave us fundus autofluorescence imaging. Mm-hmm. And what I thought was an area of just soft drusen actually then revealed itself to be an area of geographic atrophy. And I was surprised at how difficult it was to see that. Obviously, a large GA lesion we will see with imaging, but these smaller lesions will look just like a drusen patch, and you won't really see it until the FAF photo reveals it. Have you found that there's certain imaging systems that you are really relying on to detect these early changes?
Jen, you hit the nail right on the head. So every single time we get new piece of information, we start changing clinical protocols. So, you know, I told you that, yep, every single time somebody comes in, they get a standard photo. For any macular degeneration patients, anybody who's had any signs of AMD, they get the autofluorescence immediately. Here's the other thing that's interesting as well, too. There are times, so for example, a new patient's walking into the practice. Well, this software is so intelligent that I can see things as people are being pre-tested. So in our electronic medical records, I see where everybody is in the office because we follow patients throughout the office and technicians and myself. Like if we're moving patients to different spots, we just change the location of that individual. So I'm constantly looking at what are the pictures. So if I'm in the room with a patient, I'm seeing the pictures that are being taken of another individual. If I see drusen in that patient, I'll order the autofluorescence immediately by messaging the technician that's in the pretest room. For that exact same reason, Jen, some of these things truly do look like just a larger or a confluent drusen. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's something that's very, very different. And on the fundus autofluorescence, you actually see that atrophy. And the other thing too is a lot of times, so before I walk into the exam room, if, let's say, for example, I have a handful of patients this afternoon that have MAC degeneration, they'll actually get their autofluorescence, and they'll also get a MAC OCT as well too, because sometimes even too, it's difficult with autofluorescence to get sclerosing lens. If somebody's a pseudophake, that's easy. We get great photos with that. But if it's their natural or if they're still phakic, we sometimes have a difficult time with our system to get a good autofluorescence photo. So we'll do MAC OCT. This is before I see them. And you'll even sometimes pick up small areas of atrophy where you don't really see them, or it does look like this larger drusen on the photo. So you bring up some great, great clinical pearls there, Jen.
I love how this is also a little bit of a practice management discussion where these imaging systems are so powerful. If you don't have them incorporated into your practice, it you know, they will create a lot of value. I had a patient ask me the other day, and they were like, well, I was told by my last doctor that the dilation is better than the images. So I want to be dilated. I was like, I completely understand that mindset, and dilation is still a goal setter, especially for far peripheral retina. If you're trying to find, if you're talking to a retina specialist and they're trying to find tears or rips in the retina, dilation is that way yes. to do so. But there are certain parts where we're looking at glaucoma, we're looking at macular degeneration, where imaging is going to be able to find things that we would not be able to see until it's extremely advanced and cause so much devastation to vision. And so you really, really have to start thinking about incorporating both of those tools into our practice to be able to serve the entire eye, like mm-hmm. as a optometrist doing comprehensive eye exams, we're called upon yep. to do. So, yep.
Jen, you are so right. What you just described is the perfect marriage of like, how did we do things before? How do we do things with contemporary technologies? And how do we blend them all? And you're so, so, so right, Jen. You said it so eloquently.
So I love how, I mean, as we're talking about this, right, utilizing OCT, utilizing imaging, managing dry macular degeneration is very much like how we manage glaucoma in that mindset. And also, you know, we've got this treatment, right, that's it's not going to reverse geographic atrophy. It's not going to cure geographic atrophy, but we're going to try to intervene to slow the progression of geographic atrophy to preserve vision. That is exactly what we do when we prescribe a glaucoma treatment. So I think this is easy for us to adopt. We always think this way when we're managing glaucoma patients, but now we've got to think of our macular degeneration patients as glaucoma patients as well with that same mindset.
Jen, I would extend that shift in mindset to almost everything we do. Mm. I used to prescribe a -2 to a 10-year-old myope. That's it. That was the conversation. We're going to get you seeing as well as possible. The conversation now is, how do we prevent further progression? I used to prescribe artificial tears to a dry eye patient because that's all we had. I now am managing that individual to help prevent further progression because I've seen severe dry eye. And my goal is when we have early dry eye to really help that eye function better so we don't get to the moderate or severe phases. Glaucoma, we've had this mindset for decades, and now we've applied it to macular degeneration, which is absolutely fantastic. We've started to do this a little bit with the AREDS2, and that data set coming out of the AREDS2 study and even the original AREDS provided us some level of, all right, here's a wellness plan for patients. And now with treatments, we're thinking along those same lines. Yeah, okay, we have a region that's atrophied. Now, how are we going to make it so that we can do everything we can to possibly slow it down? And Jen, we're right at the beginning of this new technology. There are going to be other things that are coming out that are even going to be much more efficacious. Right now, we embrace what we have and we continue to evolve with the technologies as they become presented to us.
So we're about to get super nerdy. Anybody listening to this podcast, you know, it's something that I like to dig into the science as much as I can understand it. So Mila, can you describe what's happening with the treatment for geographic atrophy with that molecule? What's it actually doing?
Yep. So Jen, just to give you a little bit of my background, first and foremost, I love that you said we're going to nerd out a little bit. And I kind of like that because I was actually in undergrad, I was a biology major and I was a biochemistry minor. So I've always loved pathophysiological pathways. And with that said, I remember even in optometry school, I told my classmates, I said, this is the future of eye care. And they said, what do you mean? I said, pharmaceuticals, caring for patients with medications is going to be the future of eye care. I can already see it starting to establish itself. And I've always had a passion for understanding underlying mechanisms of action. And this is really one of those truly genius ways to do this. I got to take a huge step back because the word I'm going to use right now, we're not used to using in optometry or ophthalmology for that matter. And that's the complement pathway. The complement pathway happens in the background all the time in our body. And it's how we defend ourselves. So for example, if a pathogen comes in and invades me right now, and my immune system is trying to defend itself against that pathogen, it does it through several mechanisms. One is there's cells that phagocytose that cell. There's also other cells that will literally shoot proteins into that pathogen and it'll create destruction. They're almost like tiny little bombs that they put into the cell itself. And these tiny little protein bombs are called complement proteins. So what they do is they bind into things that are foreign. And what it does is it causes cellular destruction. So it binds into them. It actually causes small little defects in the cell and it causes its contents to leak out. But what it also does is it creates receptors on these pathogenic cells so that other immune cells now know to defend itself and says, hey, this is bad. We're going to start killing cells that have this on it. Well, when we're talking about pathogens, things that are invading us, that makes total sense. When the complement cascade starts to work against our own body cells, that's when we start running into things like autoimmune diseases. And that's for the purposes of our discussion here, that's when we start running into things like geographic atrophy. So you have these little complement molecules that now, instead of being targeted against pathogens, they're being targeted against the retinal cells. And as they start causing tissue destruction, we see it clinically manifesting itself as a loss of viable retina. And very early on, you just see some thinning in the OCT scans. But in more progressed states, you really start to see how the tissue just literally starts to expand in terms of the area that's actually affected. So what these newer medications are doing through injections into the eye or intraocularly is they're inhibiting these complement cascades. And there's really kind of two medications that do this right now. One is Syfovre, and that really does it through inhibiting the C3 and C3B. And when I say C3 or C3B, these are just categories of complement molecules. So C3 is one category of complement molecule. When we're looking at something like Izervay, this is something that inhibits C5. So this is just a whole other path of complement molecules. But in doing so, both of these have actually shown reduction in the expansion of the size of that atrophy over time. What's interesting with the C5 inhibition, they actually showed in a year, you could actually see a substantial reduction in the size of the GA lesion. So this is encouraging, because you're now starting to influence the future progression of this through, again, just inhibiting complement pathways. You start thinking about it and realizing, what else could you combine this molecule, this medication with? And you already start to see like what future iterations of this medicine might look like.
So what would you say to people listening to this podcast episode and think, all right, all this is interesting, I get it, I need to detect it, but only a retina specialist is going to be giving these injections. So why do I need to be focused so much on this?
Yep. So that statement right there, Jen, is probably one of the most concerning ones if an optometrist thinks that. And the reason why is this, if there's a treatment for something, you want the patient in the hands of the provider that can provide that treatment. We are not licensed to give intraocular injections. Ophthalmology or retinologists can provide those injections. So what the protocol is at this point in our office, it's very crystal clear. If I see any signs of geographic atrophy, this started a little over a year at this time, because we knew that the new medications were on the horizon. We wanted to get them into retina specialists to establish the relationship, because they needed some form of baseline so that they could see it. We actually gave them our records, so what we had up to that point. And then what they did is they established the relationship, and now they're in the hands of that retina specialist. And that retina specialist, through conversations with the patient, insurance coverage, all the stuff that typically goes through a treatment protocol, they now have that conversation with the patient. But it's so critical to have them in the retina specialist that you work with locally, their hands, so that they can start making those judgment calls. What we don't want is an individual with geographic atrophy who's now advancing, that's in our chair that we've documented as advancing, in particular in the era of treatments that are available, and saying, well, you can try this, but I don't know how well it's going to work. Well, that's an okay statement, except for the first part of it. The individual that's providing the treatment should actually be having the conversation with that patient. So again, establishing that relationship is critically important. Jen, I'll tell you though, one of the most important things in addition to that is setting up a follow-up protocol at your office. Because again, we need to make sure that those patients are as optically sound as possible. So although somebody's going to be providing the retina care, all the other eye care is still going to be provided by us. And we need to be cognizant of that, because sometimes these people feel like they're on an island. They're seeing retina specialists and they don't know when they're supposed to see us back. So make sure that that follow-up visit at your office is scheduled before they leave to go see the retina specialist, so they know what the next steps with you as their primary eye care provider is.
That's great advice. Would you mind sharing, because I think, you know, look, we've got patients that have had more advanced disease that have already lost vision. And as you said, this treatment won't restore the vision that they've lost. There is a massive shortage of low vision specialists. So in focusing on our patients' optical needs, are there any tools or tips that you have for prescribing optometrists to try to help provide patients with the best care that they can when there's an absence of a low vision referral that they can make?
Yeah. So there's a few things. First thing is, one, make sure any other ocular diseases are managed appropriately. The last thing you want a geographic atrophy patient to go through is some form of glaucomatous damage, because if they do, then now they're starting to lose peripheral vision. So if they've lost a certain amount of central vision, we want to preserve everything they have. The second thing is make sure there is no signs of any type of underlying ocular surface disease, because that can compromise things in a healthy patient, let alone the individual that's already compromised. And a third thing is pay particularly close attention to cataracts, where you may not necessarily warrant a cataract referral for an individual who's 20/25 or 20/30 with a healthy macula. Those individuals who have some form of compromise may actually benefit as a percentage of visual improvement more so than the individual with AMD, because again, they're looking for any type of advantage with their vision that they possibly can get. So now we start talking about the things that we can actually do. Well, we talked about ocular surface and glaucoma management, making sure that we're doing those. But certainly optically, we need to make sure of a few things. One, they're optimized in every single lighting situation. Mm-hmm. So be cognizant of the fact that if they require a prescription, they need to make sure that they have appropriate outdoor prescription, so sunwear, and whatever they're using inside. The other thing too is a lot of times these individuals may benefit from multiple pairs of glasses. I learned this from my senior partner with the presbyope. It's very rare that one pair of glasses can suffice or meet all of your visual needs. Looking at a heavy computer user versus glasses that you use for everything else, you can't use a pair of progressives effectively unless you want a high chiropractic bill. You can't use a pair of progressives on the computer all day without having some form of strain. So you have a second set of glasses that are specifically built for the computer screen that's going to help you focus and feel better towards the end of the day, especially if you're on the computer screen all day. Well, would that same patient with some level of low vision needs benefit from something that's prescription that's just for up close? The answer to that is yes. One of the other things I would share with you, Jen, is sometimes these patients are getting treated and they're not end-stage GA patients. They still have good functional vision. One of the things that we've started to look at much more closely is binocular posture, in particular vertical binocular posture. These people sometimes come in with the wildest complaints. Cues to say, yeah, I do think I need to do more binocular testing is, if you do your binocular balance and you remove the binocular balance and you ask the patient, do you see one row of letters? And they say, nope, I still see two. That may be your cue to start doing just a simple von Graaff euphoria in the distance for both vertical and foyer and horizontal posture as well too.
Oh, you make such a good point about all of the very subtle vertical heterophoria that's out there that I feel like I must have been missing the first 8 years I practiced with how rampant it is now. But very mild complaints, dizziness, motion sickness, night driving difficulties, the kind of things that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be thinking, oh, you've got a one prism diopter vertical displacement.
Well, Jen, one of the things we started asking too is, so, you know, when I turned it into double vision, patient says, yep. Do you ever notice that, like, in your real environment outside of the exam room? I can't believe how many people say, yep.
Wow.
So, oh, okay. Well, let's talk about how frequently that is and how you resolve the situations. And it's just, Jen, you don't know what my normal is, and I don't know what your normal is until we actually ask you. And then we identify it. We say, okay, we have something to fix that.
Makes sense. Yeah. So like you said, looking at correcting their optical, you know, and high plus, I think, is something that all optometrists are able to prescribe, but it's not going to be universal. You know, it is very person to person whether that's beneficial or not, but have them pull out their cell phone or their reading material and hold it where they hold it. Some people will shock you how far away they hold it, how close they hold it. You just can't predict. It's not 16 inches. And then demo plus from there, and you might find some surprising results.
Yep. Jen, I'll tell you too, one of the things that we always ask is, what do you want to be functional with that you feel like you're not functional with right now? Sometimes the answers surprise me. So again, as opposed to sticking to that 16 inches and saying, well, you see good at that distance, everything's good. There's usually more to the story if they're saying, I'm not seeing the way that I want to. Mm-hmm. And there's usually a specific situation. I had a jeweler the other day who said, I'm starting to lose this pre-presbyopic, but she needs a plus one because of her need for that up close vision.
So I know you mentioned earlier that for about the last year, knowing that we had treatments that were going to be getting FDA approval, you've been making a pointed decision to find those patients who might be able to benefit from a geographic atrophy treatment and make sure that they're getting into the care of a retina specialist to establish care. Have you had any patient receive treatment for geographic atrophy?
We've had several, and it's really interesting too, Jen. We've had different responses from different retinologists as well too. Some certainly that are just subtly more cautious, other individuals that after conversation with the patient, they've decided that this is the best option as well too. But I'll tell you, like, so to kind of put things, to summarize everything, because we've talked about a lot of details. One, I think as a profession, we need to understand that geographic atrophy, although it's can in some individuals be slow, it can also go fast in other patients. And there's no way to predict that patient. That's the difficult thing with it. And now that we have a treatment option, we need to be much more acute and cognizant of it. That means just catching these individuals with the technologies that we have in our offices, including the two eyes that we're looking through when we're looking at the slit lamp, but also supplementing that with imaging of the fundus through either advanced laser scanning, confocal microscopy, and also optical coherence tomography. So those are two ways that we have to do that on a daily basis. When you catch it, we need to make sure that we're discussing it and describing it to patients. And we also need to make sure that we're making appropriate referrals for nothing more than to one, establish the relationship, and two, have that retinologist determine whether or not that individual is appropriate for the treatments that are available. And I think that's really kind of changed the game for us. In light of all of that, though, I really think that you need to make sure that after the treatments or after the visit with the retinologist, they know what to do with you as their primary care provider. People want to still be cared for, and there's optical needs that we need to take care of with those patients and other eye conditions that need to be taken care of. We start to silo patients, but this individual may have dry eye, glaucoma, other needs that we can help them out with or should be helping them out with. So just make sure that we're following up with the patient after the retina specialist as well too.
Nila, thank you so much for your insights and your time today. I know I've learned a lot talking with you, and I'm sure everyone listening to the episode has too. Is there anything that you'd like to share with people as far as if they want to learn more or a resource that you like to utilize that you would send a doctor who wants to learn more too?
Oh yeah. So iZurvey, so Iveric Bio has a great website on all of this. All of the assets are there. I'm always of the opinion though, that when you're communicating with patients, the best resources that we have are the ones that are specific to that patient's eye. So if you do have imaging technologies, make sure that you display those to patients so that they understand what's going on, and make sure that you're following this area of optometry and ophthalmology, because this is changing the paradigm very, very quickly for these patients. And again, with the number of individuals that have this and can be potentially helped with this, I think we play that ground level role in making sure that they acquire and actually get the treatments that they need.
Thank you again so much for your time. And we'll see everybody again on the next episode. Until then, bye.
Bye.
All right, colleagues, and it's a wrap. Thank you dearly for hanging out with the Defocus Media team. We hope truly something resonated with you. And if it did, be sure to give us 5 stars. And make sure you follow us on all social media platforms. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, you named it. And our handle is at Defocus Media on all platforms. And until next time, be sure to keep it 2020. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.